We all know what Napoleon said to his troops before the Battle of the Pyramids, but nobody knows the precise shade of tone in which his words were spoken and the precise feeling they aroused in each soldier. Therefore, we would be more accurate in confessing that we know something about his famous exhortation, but we do not and can never know all about the evil. Words tell us what is in our imagination, not what is in the thing itself. They speak about our own imagined definition rather than about what really is. In consequence, there is a further snare which lies waiting for the heedless, against which we must also be on guard. It is impossible to verify directly any statement made by another concerning his personal experience. We can only accept the truth of his statement on an analogical or inferential basis, that is, indirectly. Whatever he tells us, all we can do is to imagine the idea that is held by his mind. Therefore, where we dupe ourselves into the belief that direct understanding has been reached and duplicate verification achieved, we really get an individual imagination. When we use the same name as others for an object, we are often deceived into thinking that all are concerned with the same object. But no object can possibly be alike in all respects to all observers. The mountain which I see is not the same as that seen by another observer who is standing in a different position, for instance. Yet we both call it by the same designation. Let us be frank with ourselves in such cases and realize that we often entertain mental images different from those of other persons, whilst both of us apply the same label to these dissimilar entities. The man who has received news of the death of a most beloved friend may, in response to a question, explain how sad he feels about the event. But his hearer can only get a rough grasp of what he hears, never of what the other man feels. And because powers of verbal expression may be feeble in the other man's case, even this approximate understanding may be still more imperfect than it would have been in another case. Anyway, the essential point is that there is and must be a gap between what the bereaved man says and what he actually feels. Therefore, this gap is a pointer to the fact that verbal meaning is necessarily both incomplete and imperfect meaning, that is not strictly accurate. Hence the word does not and cannot represent all the idea. It tells us something about the idea, it is no more than an excerpt of the total meaning, that is all. The smug satisfaction which we often fancy when we speak to express ourselves is a fallacious one. It is and shall ever be only partially supported and supportable by successful communication. Is the meaning of the word table, for instance, the mental image which rises in someone's mind with its utterance, or is it the thought of the particular object at which his hearer sits down to dine? If it is the latter, we are then faced with the problem that the particular image which rises in the hearer's mind may differ largely from the table which was being thought of by the speaker of the word. His may be a three-legged one, whereas the other is four-legged. Linguistic conventions cannot be trusted. We must evidently go beyond the mere word or its sound if we would get precision. We ought to keep clearly before us the actual relationship between the term and the thing itself. The educated man will irritably assert that he knows what words mean, but really he frequently mistakes his mastery of grammatical correctness and his width of vocabulary for the actual knowledge which this language structure represents. For words are not things. It is easy to confuse the written word with the actual thing, or to forget that the spoken word is only an abstraction made from the thing it signifies. At the best, a word will convey only a selective approximation of the thought or emotion, the event or the fact, which is in its speaker's mind. Such an error may turn the word into a stumbling block which prevents a proper knowledge of the object itself. The student of philosophy must therefore take care to separate the word from their thought it stands for and the thought again from the thing it stands for. Then only may he perceive accurately what worth the word has for him. He must analyze individual words and sentence structures by retranslating them into factual rather than imagined reference. This demands probing beneath surfaces as a surgeon probes with his lancet. He must be quite clear on this point, that the meaning of a word may itself be purely verbal, that is nothing more than a number of other words, or it may be utterly non-verbal, that is an actual thing. And if it is the latter, there is the further question of how much of that thing is symbolized by the word. Descriptive sentences tell us something about a part of an object, but they fail to tell us about the whole of it because they are necessarily always abstractions. For this they are not to be blamed, as they possess, like all things, their limitations, and we ought not to expect them to perform miracles. But, this said, we need not make matters worse by being loose, slipshod, vague and careless when pouring thought stuff into the linguistic matrix. It is customary for most of the untechnical laity, when first presented with these problems of meaning, to brush them aside as being too obvious for special attention or too trivial for prolonged consideration. And even professed students of philosophy are not infrequently highly impatient when subjected to this novel cross-examination of what seems plain and familiar everyday language. They regard it as a waste of time at best and a positive nuisance at worst. They can see neither tangible profit nor particular interest in such a task. Nor can they see its connection with the quest of truth. They ask, what has all this preoccupation with mere words to do with philosophy? Is it not the proper concern of the philologist only? The answer is that the full implication of such semantic study can come only with the fuller unfoldment of this course. Only when this research is well advanced will the student come adequately to realize for himself why the importance of this investigation has been insisted on, in face of the fact that most educated people assume that they understand quite well the words which they habitually use. Nevertheless, even within the limit of the present chapter, something of its usefulness will be shown. The would-be philosopher who has equipped himself psychologically for his expedition will see the whole expanse of existence as his province. He has to set out to explore subsurfaces for the truth of what he hears or reads, as well as what he says or writes, for the truth of the world around him, for the truth of what he thinks and what others think, and for the truth of the world within, that is the mind. But he has to start somewhere, and it will be most convenient to start at the nearest point, which means that he should begin with words, because all his other knowledge will have to be formulated in words. His inquiry starts then by making himself as mentally uneasy and as linguistically uncomfortable as possible. He has to go out to do some ghost-laying. For most men, perhaps all men, have been conversing with thin phantoms and dealing with transparent wraiths under the delusive impression that they were solid figures of flesh. In short, he has to find out how much of his word-formulated thought loo and speech is sheet nonsense, and how much is verifiable and veritable fact, how much is mere misunderstanding, and how much is authentic interpretation. The more he makes his meanings clear to himself and to others, the nearer he gets to truth. Non-ambiguity is therefore an essential ingredient of the efficient philosophic vocabulary. The arbitrary use of words may often be unimportant in the world of mundane matters, but where the reception or communication of truth is in question, he must be extremely careful to fix their precise significance, so as to render them immune to misunderstanding. With a well-defined set of terms constituting a common language between writer and reader, both may hope to make some progress. Without it, both may fall into the old trap of building up an entire philosophical structure out of nothing more substantial than mere ambiguity. To consider such verbal dissection as pure pedantry is therefore quite wrong. It is part of the essential equipment for ascertaining truth. Whoever will not give time to this preparatory effort is doomed to remain outside the porch of philosophy. Many hope to evade this fatiguing labor and yet gain the slow-growing fruits of philosophy. How little do they know that an appreciative mastery of verbal analysis will later enable them to turn the flanks of specious arguments and false assumptions, thus clearing the ground for their onward progress towards truth. For words grow into sentences, which in their turn develop into entire systems of statements that embody whole trains of thinking. If the words themselves presuppose what is actually false, who can get at truth by mingling them with other words? If men persist in maintaining an attitude of indifference towards the problems of meaning, they render themselves unfit to proceed with further philosophical study, for the psychological effect of their obstinacy is nothing less than the desertion of the labor of thinking, and nothing more than an unspoken claim to knowledge, which, in fact, does not really exist inside their heads. It is equivalent to a sudden paralysis of the reasoning faculty. It leads to acceptance of specious arguments. They ignorantly imagine that such problems are purely fanciful and academic and belong to the region of worthless medieval discussions, such as the one already mentioned of how many angels could dance on the point of a needle. In this they are wholly mistaken. The solution of these problems has both a practical and philosophical application, a value quite unsuspected by those who have not deeply delved into them. This demand for philosophic precision in the handling of terms is not an arbitrary one. It is really a demand for clearing the ground, because progress is impeded by false and misleading notions. It is a demand that we examine words in order to draw a clear line between fact and falsity, detect the fallacies which underlie their use, and lay bare unwarranted or unconscious assumptions. We are thus to watch for unguarded expressions which give a status to meaningless nonsense. Strange discoveries about truth, God and spirit. Philosophy is the comprehensive quest of impregnable truth, the underlying significance of all existence. Most men who subscribe to the doctrine of a particular religion, cult, or school of thought lazily adopt an attitude which regards those doctrines as constituting the last word in wisdom, an attitude which is often most impatient of contradiction. The unconscious implication of such an attitude is therefore, they know that this is true. But how is it possible for them to be certain that what they know is true if they have not previously examined its very foundations analytically and critically? If they have not made a similar study of all comparative and conflicting doctrines, and above all if they have not still earlier endeavored to ascertain the proper meaning of truth. We cannot do better, in order to provide a glimpse into one philosophical application of the principles just laid down, than to start examining into the meanings given to this word truth by some contemporaries. Let us take pains to discover what the learned can inform us about truth. We find it defined in a standard dictionary as being true or truthful, a true statement, accuracy of representation, the real explanation. When we turn to the writings of philosophers to ascertain their definition, an interesting variety of theories of truth or opinions of truth is put before us. The pragmatic school says, with William James, that the true is the name of whatever proves itself to be good in the way of belief. Those who hold to the correspondence theory say that truth is that which conforms to fact and corresponds to the actual situation. The protagonists of the coherence theory say that truth is consistency. Others say that the word truth is liable to four further interpretations. It may firstly be taken as something that is unopposed. It may secondly be taken as indicating a factual reality, it may thirdly be taken as merely a statement about that factual reality, lastly it may indicate a correct relation existing between two things, two persons or two units as 3 plus 2 equals 5. From this medley of mutually conflicting definitions we perceive that the term is so protean that it is strictly no better than a strange jargon, and that the common belief that everyone knows its meaning is merely an erroneous assumption. The differences in connotation are too wide to make clear-cut sense. Yet the world uses this word truth glibly and pretends to possess an adequate understanding of its meaning. This is where the world obviously deceives itself. The ordinary man soon falls a victim to the seductive simplicity of this short word and never dreams that it is nothing more than a starting post in the race for philosophic understanding. Yet to him it is the finishing post. The hardest thing in the world is to reach truth, the easiest to reach its simulacrum. That is why every man fancies he knows the truth. In the philosophical dictionary this word should be assigned the most important place of all, as it is in the best texts of India, but the West has been unable to find a fixed definition to which its thinkers can agree. Generally they have not occupied themselves with the question of defining truth, although they are familiar with the importance of the general principle of defining their terms. But it is their common belief that the nature of the ultimate truth cannot be determined and that therefore it is useless to attempt to define the unknowable. But if philosophy is to live up to its professed purpose of ascertaining the meaning of the whole, that is the truth of the whole, what other fate awaits its writers and readers than a fall into obscurity when this most important word evades uncontradictable definition? Those few, however, who have attempted the task offer such unashamedly different denotations that it is quite clear they are offering mere opinions under elaborate linguistic guise. All the current definitions have their weaknesses and can be overthrown by a keen mentality. We thus arrive at the appalling position that the meaning of some of the most important words used in the quest of truth is not fixed but is purely relative to their interpretation. Such a discovery helps to explain, however, why Buddha maintained a calm silence when a hearer questioned him as to the nature of nirvana and why Jesus maintained a similar silence when Pontius Pilate questioned him as to the nature of truth. Whatever answer either of these two would have given would inevitably have meant something imagined, hence something different, in the mind of the questioner from what it meant in the speaker's own mind. But the complete explanation of these mysterious silences belongs to the most advanced part of this course. It will perhaps be asked, where is the grave importance of arriving at a universally acceptable and completely uncontradictable definition of the nature of truth before actually arriving at truth itself? The answer must be that we are like explorers in an unknown continent who must have a guide to direct their movements, whether that guide be a living man or a mechanical compass. A trustworthy definition of truth would provide right direction for the efforts of thinkers by showing them the path to be followed for its attainment. It would warn them like the moving needle of a compass whenever they were headed for delusion, error and deception, and it would encouragingly reassure them whenever they were going forward to the right goal. It would blaze perpetually in the mental sky like the pole star so that they need not lose themselves in useless speculation or grope vainly among fanciful theories. Nor is this all. It would prevent them deceiving themselves into the acceptance of a truth merely because it be pleasant to their taste. It would enable them to avoid acceptance of their own or someone else's imagination about truth as being truth itself. It would give a final certitude of outlook unpossessed by those who do not know whether what they believe is truth or not and who are therefore always liable to change their mind. A further glimpse of the philosophical value of vigorous verbal analysis may now be given. How many men are wholly drugged or half-awed by the mere sound of an impressive word like God and thus deflected from calm verification and impartial analysis of all its implication? This word gives great comfort and magical solace to millions of people, but the truth seeker, alas, can derive no comfort from it in advance before he has considered the thought itself rather than the word. Because society has used this word continuously throughout several centuries, superficial minds come to assume that the word must therefore represent a something which exists within human experience, which is the student, however, must first analyze psychologically what they have done. For he must start with a basis of inquiry which shall be dogma-free and yet fruitful for the growth of understanding, otherwise it is mere verbiage. Specific and accurate definition must be this starting point in study. He has not the good fortune of those glib clergymen and wise theologians who speak of God with such familiarity and such certitude as to give the impression that they were doubtless present when he created the world, or at least as if, in the words of Matthew Arnold, he were a person in the next street. The first thing which he then discovers is that this brief three-letter word can be understood in many different senses. As he rummages through the cluster of pious associations which it possesses, he soon perceives that 10 men may utter the word God, but important differences of view may lie concealed beneath each utterance, although it is heard as one and the same sound. The word may mean a personal or an impersonal being, it may mean the abstract totality of the laws of nature or a particular individual existence, a piece of carven wood or a molded metal image. In the mind of a primitive man it is a purely animistic term, whereas in the mind of the late Lord Haldane it was an abstract and absolute one. The student should not limit his inquiry to the conception held in his immediate locality or in his country or among his race. He is a seeker after the truth of all life and therefore he must collect and compare conceptions from every quarter of the globe. He will then discover that there are racial gods like Jehovah, tribal gods galore, personal rulers of the universe like Vishnu, and impersonal and universal spirits without any form at all, and that the human mind, in its primitivity, worships a deity totally unlike that which it worships in its maturity. His attempt to get under the skin of this term and fix its full significance thus carries him into a weary task which is as interminable as it is inconsequential. For do what he may, he is wholly unable to discover what exactly is meant by this disarmingly short word. It is susceptible of a diversity of strange interpretations. It may furnish 15 meanings to as many persons. It has probably given rise to more nebulous vaporizing than any other word in the dictionary. All that he can discover is what a multitude of persons, ranging from simple Fiji Islanders to finished university graduates, imagine, believe, hope, suppose, trust or visualize the meaning may be, but none, not a single person, really knows what it is. The bewildering consequence is that all their definitions contradict each other. The diversity of definitions given to God, not merely by uncouth barbarians but by educated people, is really scandalous. Few mental gods are alike, because they are forced to use words as prime elements of their thinking, because meaning must first flow into word shapes before it can be properly appropriated by the mind. This motley multitude of talkers about God do not really know what they are talking about when they do not know the precise meaning of the word. And not only do they not know themselves what they are talking about, but those who listen to them do not really understand them either. For the notions that are received and formed in their minds are likely to be quite other than those formed by the minds of the talkers. All, in fact, have objectified their personal assumptions into the word and through the latter into the world that environs them. The student of philosophy should not submit unresistingly to such an extraordinary situation. He must put himself on guard and take antiseptic precautions against these serious dangers to mental health. He has to apply the test of disinterested thinking to the confident talk about God which constantly pours into his ears or passes in print before his eyes. He cannot do this merely by consulting a printed dictionary for an answer to the question, "What is the significance of God?" He should know that all dictionaries are merely attempts to stabilize meanings and that they have never fully succeeded in their aim because different dictionaries offer different meanings, and that after all they are but indicators of interpretational opinion existing at the time of compilation. Their authority is not absolute. He can do it only by reframing his question thus: what is felt in my mind when I use this word? What is there in experience of the world or life which corresponds to the term God? Thus, when we deeply consider the meaning of meaning, we find that it is, after all, only an idea in the mind, a thought which we hold, or even an imagination which we construct. And because it possesses a purely mental existence, it is never possible to compare the idea held in one man's mind with that held in another's. Two external objects such as pencils can easily be placed side by side and compared, but not two internal ideas. Consequently, each hearer or reader of a word may and will imagine only what he prefers as the meaning. Accurate communication and perfect reception are thereby defeated. Such a defeat can only be averted by entering more carefully into cautious examination and prior definition. When the student has not only understood how to assess the worth of words, but also how to assess the meaning of meaning, then the time has come when he may hope to discover what God truly is, in contrast to what some people merely imagine him to be, but before then, never. His discovery will not come at once. It will not be made indeed until the end of his philosophic quest, but if he perseveres it will come, and thereafter he will no more be deceived by the graven images of false gods. A word which has also played much part in entrapping men in false conceptions or bewildering them with vague ones is spiritual. It has been used by totalitarian dictators to label their outlook on life, but it has also been used by their opponents. There is something ironic in the way in which dictators and democrats have mutually accused each other of being materialistic and unspiritual. There is obviously much confusion here in the notions possessed by politicians about this attractive word. But when we enter into the spheres of religion and mysticism, the confusion increases greatly. We hear of spiritual experiences which, on analytical examination, turn out to be magnificent emotional titillations, or extremely imaginative flights, or beautiful moods of intense peace, or crudely sentimental conversions, or visions of immaterial beings, and so on. The possible interpretations are therefore many. Finally, if we say that a certain man is very spiritual, one hearer thinks it means that he is noble in character, another believes that it indicates he is possessed of a tranquil temperament, a third imagines that he lives a life of ascetic simplicity and solitude, a fourth pictures him as being ultra-religious, whilst a fifth regards him as living in a mysterious state of consciousness unknown to ordinary mortals, and so forth. Thus each definition differs from all the others. Let us now analyze more deeply the implication of the word spiritual. Whatever be the nature of anyone's spiritual experience or consciousness, trace it to analytical terminus and it will be discovered that it is his mind that tells him of it, and it is his mind that enables him to know it as existent in his life. Now the mind can only make us aware of anything, whether it be a tiny fly or a great god, by entertaining the thought of it. Therefore whatever is known in any way is known ultimately as a thought. Spiritual experiences and spiritual consciousness are no exception to this universal rule. They too are really nothing more than thoughts, however unusual in character they might otherwise be. Hence there is no difference between the word spiritual and the word mental. All conscious life is thought life. The most spiritual man lives in thoughts as much as the most materialistic man. He cannot do otherwise and remain awake. It is now possible to understand not only why people form no clear and consistent notion of the meaning of spiritual, but also why they never can form one. All that they can do is unconsciously to construct imaginatively a meaning which pleases their personal taste or temperament. The philosopher must refuse to be captivated by the charm of this word and by deeper thinking discipline his own use of the term so that he achieves clarification of what he is talking about. What is a fact? A fourth linguistic enemy, against whose superficial acceptance the philosopher must war lest it deceive and entrap him in illusion, is fact. For the philosophy of truth prides itself in being based on facts rather than on beliefs. But what is a fact? Here is a word whose meaning in everyday usage is commonly taken for granted, but even a slight analytical inquiry will show that it treacherously shades off into quite a number of other nuances. If anyone arbitrarily accepts the first or third of all these interpretations because the effort of further inquiry is too troublesome, how can he assure himself that his knowledge is really based on facts? Suppose a boy is walking home in the dim twilight and notices that a coiled snake is lying beside the road. He hurries on and later meets another traveler, who, however, is proceeding in the opposite direction. The former deems it his duty to inform him of the fact that a snake is resting further along the road and to warn him against accidentally treading on it and being bitten in consequence. The next day the boy meets the same man, who informs him that he shot at the snake and then approached it. To his astonishment, he found it to be no reptile at all, but merely a coil of thick rope. The dimness of the light had deceived them both. The reptile was but a creature of their unverified imagination, an unconscious self-deception. Was it a fact that the boy saw a snake? The answer must be yes. Was it a fact that the object seen was really a rope? The answer must again be in the affirmative. But suppose he had never met the other man again, would he not have stoutly asserted it was a fact that he had seen a snake, just as the man would now stoutly assert the fact that the boy had not seen any snake at all? It will be clear to the thoughtful mind that we must be more wary when using this term. If a fact is something reported by the five senses, then it is possible for the senses to deceive us and to provide us with a misrepresentation of it. In that case, the student must add the word fact to the list whose uncritical use he ought to regard with suspicion. If, instead of thinking, "I have seen a snake," he had thought, "I have seen something which appears to have the characteristics of a snake," he would not have misled himself and others so easily. This, however, is the simplest of his difficulties in accepting the term. Words which belong to the pre-scientific age and to conceptions far off in time and space still permeate our language and may actually mislead him now that their referent is something about which contemporary knowledge shows an enormous extension. The results which have been achieved in our generation could not have been achieved in any earlier age, for they have largely been made possible by the marvelous new instruments and delicate apparatus, which have been devised and invented to help the five senses function where they could not function so finely before. Thus the microscope, the telescope and the spectroscope, the sensitive photographic surface and the photoelectric cell have made visual reports possible which the unaided human eye could not have got otherwise,